Sometimes you gotta have a backup to your backup of your backup. Harvey is a lesson in what can happen when you don't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 31st of August. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. Early this morning, a refrigerated storage container at the Arkema Chemical plant in Crosby, Texas, a container that was, in fact, no longer refrigerated because the flooding had killed the power systems and their backup, had what the Harris County Sheriff calls a chemical reaction. The company initially said it exploded. Either way, it's bad. The company says 8 more containers could go off as well. And think for just a second here about how many petrochemical plants are underwater in Texas right now. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath gets us going with the finer points of redundant infrastructure.
Orrin Hayes lives 5 miles away from the Arkema plant, but the explosion still woke him up.
Yeah, we just felt a little quick boom in the window valve just a little bit.
By the time we talked, it was 90 degrees in Crosby. But Hayes had cut the AC and stuffed towels around all his doors and windows.
I'm just worrying about what we're going to be breathing. It's me, my wife, and my 2 daughters. One is 2 weeks old and one is 10 years old.
Hayes is especially worried because he works at a chemical plant, fixing industrial equipment like the generators that failed at Arkema. He's never worked there, he says, but at another plant nearby, if the generators are going underwater,
they have a contingency plan that literally takes the chemicals and dumps them into another bat that neutralizes that chemical.
Safely disposing of dangerous chemicals is a common way that plants get ready for emergencies, says Sam Mannon. He studies safety and chemical engineering at Texas A&M.
Almost every material that we handle, we know how to prevent bad outcomes from it.
Mannon says he can't speculate right now on what Arkema might have done right or wrong. But in general,
most chemical plants prepare for events like this by taking facilities to, quote-unquote, a fail-safe mode, a fail-safe shutdown.
But every layer of backup is another expense, he says. Companies buy the level of safety they want. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Told you yesterday about the president's tax speech out in Missouri. Today, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin continued the politicking on CNBC. Question one was about the lack of an actual White House plan to overhaul the Internal Revenue Code.
Well, first of all, there absolutely is a package.
Technically, it's one page, couple of bullet points.
The House and the Senate are now socializing the plan with their members. We're going to release a blueprint, and it's going to go to committee, and we're going to turn this into a bill which the president will sign.
Timing?
We talked about originally our goal had been August. Unfortunately, things got delayed a bit. But we're on a track to get this done by the end of the year. So you're going to see the details come out later this month. It's going to go through a committee process. And we expect the House and the Senate will get this to the president to sign this year. And we couldn't be more excited about the progress we've made.
By the end of the month, I think he did mean the end of September, which starts tomorrow. By the way, just to be clear, the White House and Congress are looking for the whole smash on this thing. Corporate income taxes, closing or cutting back some really popular loopholes, individual tax rates and brackets. It is going to be a heavy lift. On Wall Street today, we're seeing some Harvey effects come into pretty sharp relief here. RBOB gas, which is basically futures in unleaded gas, hit a 2-year high today, up 28% from a week ago. Refineries are closed. As you know, supply gets tight. And that's how it goes, supply-demand-wise. Crude oil was up a bit today, down a bunch for the month of August. Oh, and stocks? Yeah, they were up. So what else is new? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Jared Kushner, son-in-law of the President of the United States and a senior advisor to him, has a problem. That problem sits on Fifth Avenue, smack in the middle of Manhattan, and on it hangs the fortunes of Kushner family businesses and some questions about how Jared Kushner is going to get the money to pay the mortgage on his problem. David Kochanowski has a big piece in Bloomberg today about the building and the Kushner Company's efforts to finance it. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This article, I will tell you, is ominous from the very beginning, the very first line. Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law and top advisor, wakes up each morning to a growing problem that will not go away. What are we talking about here?
We're talking about the trophy tower of the Kushner real estate empire, 666 Fifth Avenue. Jared and his father bought it back in 2007 at the height of the real estate market. They paid at the time a record price and took on a huge amount of debt. And since that time, they've been scrambling to try to make it work. And they have a mortgage due in about 18 months, and the building has been losing money intermittently. So they're under a lot of pressure.
They are looking for how much money to pay that mortgage bill due in 18 months?
You know, the mortgage is $1.2 billion, and they own half the building. But they've at different times they've looked for much more money. One of the Kushner's proposals to try to save the building is to knock it down and build a huge tower on top of it, something that would cost involve a $4 billion construction loan. They've been trying to raise money from different sovereign wealth funds, from private wealthy individuals, and from real estate consortiums. And so far, the numbers have not attracted people.
They have, though, since Mr. Kushner went to the White House with his father-in-law. Their calls, you say, have been getting answered with greater regularity than they did in the past couple of years.
In the late 2015, early 2016, as Donald Trump rose through the ranks of the Republican primaries and started his way to the White House, and Jared Kushner was very closely aligned with him, there were people who would take more meetings. We should also point out Jared, since January, has technically divested himself of interest in the building. He sold his interest to other family members. So since joining the administration, he personally is not involved on a day-to-day basis, but it's still his family fortune is largely tied up in the company and in the building.
Let's talk about some of the folks they have approached for financing. One of them is the Anbang Corporation out of China. Tell us a little bit about them.
Anbang is a Chinese, a big insurance company that has a huge amount of investment, and they have tried to buy real estate in the U.S., have bought some real estate in the U.S. They are so closely tied to the Chinese government that the U.S. government has forbidden them from buying certain properties in sensitive areas like near military bases. So the Kushners originally started to talk to them in 2015 and in 2016, both before and after the election. Jared met with them, and the deal ended up being fallen apart because Anbang was under some pressure in China, and there was questions about whether the Kushner family should be involved with a company that is so closely aligned with the Chinese ruling party.
You point out that Kushner has stepped back from control of this company, but you end this piece with the meeting that Jared Kushner had in December with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, of course, in Trump Tower. But also he later met with a guy by the name of Sergei Gorkov, who's the head of a Kremlin-controlled bank. And federal investigators are aware of that, and they're looking into that. Do we think that was part of his search for cash that we've been talking about?
I think that is a question that certainly congressional people have asked and then a lot of people on the outside. We don't know the answer to it. Jared Kushner has said publicly and said in when he spoke to Congress that was not a talk about business or money, that he never mixes business and his official duties. As we pointed out in the story, both the bank and Vladimir Putin's spokesman said that that was a meeting about business. They didn't mention 666 or any particular property, but they said, no, we met with him as a businessman because you're talking to leading business people about different aspects of the economy and development. And so I think, you know, that is what congressional investigators and what everyone in Washington wants to know what actually happened in those conversations.
David Kochanowski writing in Bloomberg about Jared Kushner and the Kushner family and their building in Manhattan. David, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
President Trump is finding himself squeezed a little bit by a group of Republican state attorneys general. They have threatened to file suit on September the 5th, that is this coming Tuesday, unless Trump overturns DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program put in place by President Obama to let people who were brought here illegally as children stay and get work authorizations. For as human a story as this is, and it is also deeply economic, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
This week, the pro-immigration group Forward.us issued a report saying nearly 700,000 DACA recipients are legally employed right now. Tom Javits is at the Center for American Progress, which co-published the report.
DACA has unlocked the enormous economic potential of this population. 91% are employed, 5% have started their own businesses.
If DACA is repealed, hundreds of thousands of work authorizations will expire over the next 2 years, and Javits says those workers could then be dismissed. Critics of DACA argue that people who arrived in the U.S. without documentation, at whatever age, shouldn't be allowed to work and take jobs away from U.S. citizens. But economist Ray Perryman says the U.S. already has very low unemployment and a lot of unfilled jobs.
These people are not displacing U.S. workers, and if they left, we'd have a hard time replacing them.
Tamar Jacoby at Immigration Works, which favors more legal immigration, says a lot of DACA recipients have gone to college. They're working as nurses, teachers, lawyers. If they're dismissed, they
might be living lives in the shadows, just scraping by on the kinds of jobs that, you know, that you can get away with not proving your legal status.
Employers could find themselves in a legal gray area, too, uncertain whether to dismiss expired DACA workers to stay on the right side of the immigration laws, but possibly facing discrimination charges if they do. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
To put things in context, we made 2.5 times more than Dunkirk in Mexico.
Hollywood isn't the only place to make movies, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 55 points. Today, about 0.25%. Finished at 21,948. Did the blue chips. NASDAQ up 60 points, 0.9%. 64.28. The S&P 500 advanced 14, about 0.5%, 24.71. Retail stocks rallied. Commerce Department figures out today showed consumer spending picked up last month. Amazon up 1.3%. Jeweler Tiffany buffed up 4.25%. Michael Kors put on about 0.3% today. Wells Fargo weakened 0.5% today. The bank revealed this morning it may have opened a total of 3.5 million customer accounts without those customers' permission, rather than the 2.1 million disclosed when the scandal broke a year ago. May have. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.11%. Looking at you again is the bond market, Janet Yellen. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal, with the caveat that it is still really early days yet, getting the Gulf Coast out from under the damage that Harvey left behind and acknowledging the loss of life. We do know already that recovery and rebuilding in Texas and parts of Louisiana is going to be expensive. Tens of billions of dollars easy, $100 billion or more possibly. Writing in Politico magazine in a story called How Washington Made Harvey Worse, Michael Grunwald says Congress should have, and in a way did, see this coming. Mike, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Kai.
We need to establish a little baseline here, I think, before we get going too much farther. There's a report that you begin your piece with. It's called Higher Ground, 1998, from the National Wildlife Federation. What did it say?
You know, it was a report about the National Flood Insurance Program and essentially how dysfunctional it was. They focused a lot on how there were these repetitive loss properties, homes and businesses that just got flooded over and over again. They actually had a poster child that had been flooded 16 times in 18 years. And of course, that home was in Houston, which is where they actually released the report. And the author of the report said that day, "Houston, we have a problem." And he said that there was much worse coming in the future.
That report was written 30 years after the National Flood Insurance Program started. We are now 20 years beyond that. It is still a mess, the National Flood Insurance Program. And more to the point of your piece, you say Congress should have known this was coming.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, 3 years after Higher Ground, there was a tropical storm that hit Houston and cost $5 billion worth of damage. In 2015, there was a no-name rain event that was one of the 15 costliest floods in U.S. history. And then in 2016, there was another no-name rain event that was one of the 15 costliest floods in U.S. history. So this is not a surprise. They're called floodplains because it's plain that they flood.
Part of what's going on here is the maps that lay out flood zones and on which the flood insurance program is based. The problem, of course, is that those maps are, in essence, politically negotiable.
Yeah, and they're really absurd. I mean, when you build in the floodplains, not only are you putting more homes and businesses in harm's way, you're paving over these wetlands and prairies that used to soak up excess floodwaters, and you're pouring it right into the bayous and the rivers, and you're making those floods worse. And that's why you have the $8 billion floods in U.S. history have all been in the last couple decades.
The flood insurance program is, as we've all heard repeatedly the past five, 6 days or so, it's $25 billion in the hole. How did it get that way? Is it just paying out more than it took in premiums?
Yeah, that's a pretty pretty succinct way of putting it. I mean, I lived in Miami Beach for a while, and it was extraordinary how cheap my my flood insurance was. It's way below actuarial rates. It's surprising it's only $25 billion in debt. It's about to go much more.
It needs to be reauthorized by the end of September. Jeb Hensarling, the chairman of the relevant committee in the House of Representatives, has some plans to overhaul it. I guess more plans because we've had them in the past. What are the odds this thing gets A, funded again, and B, fixed?
Well, it's funny. I'm sure it'll get funded because of the disaster. There's going to be a lot of pressure, and there's always a lot of pressure because you can't get a mortgage without flood insurance. So everybody wants the flood insurance program to go. In 2012, there actually was some flood insurance reforms that were going to try to make it more actuarially sound to reflect the risk of people living in these flood-prone areas, and they actually got bipartisan support. But then people's flood insurance premiums started going up. Everybody freaked out. And there was another bipartisan bill in 2014 that essentially unreformed it. So I think it's going to be very difficult. There's going to be a lot of pressure to just reauthorize the program, keep it going, and make sure those disaster checks keep coming.
Mike Grunwald, he writes for Politico Magazine. His piece that we're talking about today is called How Washington Made Harvey Worse. Mike, thanks a lot.
Anytime, Guy.
There's a movie opening this weekend called Do It Like a Man. That's the English language title. In the original Spanish, it's Hazlo Como Hombre, a comedy about a guy who comes out as gay to his friends and family and how his best friend just can't quite wrap his brain around it. The movie set box office records when it was released in Mexico, which is due partly to the mechanics of how this film was made. Nicolas Lopez wrote, directed, and produced. Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
What's it like waiting for this movie to open in the States after the success you had in Mexico?
It's crazy because it's a movie that nobody wanted to make.
Really?
So, yeah. So from but that has been the history of my life. Like, I always try to make things in a very different way, and people always get really, really scared. And then when they are a success, everybody's like, oh, yeah, we always knew that it was going to be a hit.
I'll tell you what. This movie, while we're not going to give it away, does things in a very different way. You are Chilean.
Yes.
And yet you did this film
in
Mexico with Mexican actors. How come?
Yeah, it's even weirder than that. Like, I shot this movie in Chile with Mexican actors.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, so I brought everybody down to Chile.
Okay.
And we shot everything there, and we shot the movie really, really fast. Like, this movie, we made this movie for less than $1 million. Like, we made it for like 800,000, something like that. So, and the thing is that because I created a system in Chile where that we call Chilewood. And
Chilewood?
Yeah, it's really stupid. So
no,
basically,
man, it works, man. Branding
works.
Is everything.
No. But the thing is that we make like 5 movies per year. So basically what I have is that I have everybody on staff. So like from my VP to everybody that does a post-production.
Yeah.
So we are forced to make movies.
Well, this is so interesting. So are you a filmmaker or are you an entrepreneur?
I think that I have always been an entrepreneur because like being a film director in Chile is like being an astronaut in Zimbabwe, you know? It's like something that doesn't make any sense at all whatsoever. That being said, I have produced more than 30 movies, and I also, and what happened to me, like, it's really cool because I ended up making movies here in the U.S. where, we did a movie 2 years ago called Knock Knock, starring Keanu Reeves, and we shot that whole movie in Chile. We shot Chile for L.A., and wow. and the movie went to Sundance, but then the movie was like dumped, you know, it was like a VOD release.
Straight to video.
Exactly.
Yep.
So it was like really frustrating. And then I was like, you know what? I need to make a really, really, really cheap movie. And I did a movie for less than $300,000 that was called Sin Filtro or No Filter. And that movie ended up grossing more than Star Wars in my country.
Wow.
And then I was like, you know what? Like, that's the way of making movies for the U.S.
Okay, so what are you going to do if this movie lands big in the U.S. and the major studios come to you and say, here's $100 million to make the next, you know, whatever it is. What are you going to do?
Say no, because like...
Really?
Yeah, because more money is more problems. And I think that that's the thing about what happens here a lot is that people love to talk about making movies, but they don't like making movies. You know? So and they love the whole part of like, oh, my agent and my whatever, and we're dealing with this. And
you know,
and
you're sitting in L.A., right? I mean, those
I know.
Kinds of people are like surrounding you.
I know. And it's all about like, oh, my lawyer, and I'm getting 2 or 5 points, you know? But at the end of the day, it's like people care more about, you know, like the contracts and everything than actually making the movies, because they know that if one movie hits, you know, they are rich. And what happens with me is that if one movie hits, it's amazing, but then I need to make another one. And another one, and another one, and another one. It's like going to the gym. And right now what happened with Hazlo con Hombre is that I'm getting our production company and everything with what happened in Mexico. Of course, we're getting way more money than if I were making like a big movie here in the U.S. Huh. To put things in context, we made 2.5 times more than Dunkirk in Mexico.
Wow.
You know? And 2 times more than Baby Driver. With a movie that cost $700,000.
So what's really funny is you say you don't want the $100 million budget, but you count those pennies, man, because you know exactly
for
how
sure.
much.
I'm a producer and I'm a director. No, I want to make movies for, like, I'm not being an artist at all. Like I want to make movies for a really for big audiences. But the thing is that I don't want to have to be involved in the whole process of not being my own boss.
Can we talk for a second about how Latinos are portrayed in your films? You were quoted, I guess, in the LA Times not too long ago. You want to show Latinos, quote, as normal people, not all poor and barefoot, and we don't know what Wi-Fi is.
Mm-hmm. And I said that like 10 years ago. Yeah. Of course, the thing about Latinos, like, I realized that I was Latino when I came here, you know?
Wow.
Like, I was like, oh, so I'm a Latino. Oh, so what, do I have to be, like, eating tacos? Like, that's what, it's like, okay, can somebody explain to me, like, what is being a Latino? Because I'm from Chile. I was raised watching, like, big Hollywood movies from the 80s. You know, like, I was raised watching Ghostbusters and Back to the Future and The Terminator, and those were my movies. And every TV show that I watched were TV shows from the U.S., but I also have a huge influence from Spain, from Mexico. So when I got here, suddenly we're like, oh, people are trying to put me in a box because I was born in South America.
I wonder, you've alluded to this a little bit, how it's, you know, we in the States think Latino and it's everybody.
Of course.
South of the Rio Grande.
It's very different.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's actually, I mean, there's Chileans and there are Mexicans.
Yeah.
And the idea that there's a Spanish-speaking film industry is just a misnomer.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that the best thing that could happen to us in a really weird way is Trump, because now we have a reason to hate somebody, you know, as a group. Because what happened before is that Argentinians didn't like Chileans didn't like Peruvians, Mexicans didn't like, you know, so we were very separated, you know,
yep.
So now we have a common enemy. And in a way, that's amazing. You see that people are are watching more Mexican films in Mexico because that's also a reaction. And that's how suddenly we made a movie in Chile with Mexican actors that was released in Mexico. And now it's being released in the U.S. It's insane.
It's called Hazlo como Hombre by Nicolas Lopez. Thank
Do
you
it
so
like
much.
An hombre. Thanks a lot.
This final note on the way out today, in which I declare victory and depart the field in the somehow still going on debate over whether pumpkin spiced anything has jumped the shark. The answer, by the way, is yes, and I submit as my final piece of evidence and the very last time the words pumpkin spice are going to pass my lips, this item from the Native Company out of San Francisco for $12 even, free shipping, available September the 5th, pumpkin spice latte deodorant. That's it. I'd drop the mic if the engineers wouldn't get mad. All right, we are out of here on this last day of August. The Dow up 55 points, about 0.25%. NASDAQ up 60 points, 0.9%. S&P 500 advanced 14 points, about 0.5%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, he's actually off this week, is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rosendahl. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.